Well, Monday Night History. When it comes to sport being a part of Australia's national identity, there's no doubt that all codes kick goals. We're a nation united by a love of sport, aren't we? But interestingly, not all sports are loved equally across the different states. That's for sure. Australian rules football has traditionally been considered our country's national game. Although, if you made that claim in Queensland and New South Wales, you might likely find yourself an argument to some degree. So, how did Australian rule football? How did Australian rules begin? How did it gain a foothold and a following in Victoria? And how did it spread from there? Apparently, there were lots of different factors at play, including the push for the 8-hour working day. Why, though, did Aussie rules not germinate so rapidly in New South Wales and Queensland? To help tell the story of the rise of the national football game, for our history segment this week, we welcome Tony Wood, a fellow in historical studies at the University of Melbourne. Tony, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil. Thank you for your interest.
Well, no, I'm sure it'll be of interest to great many people. At the MCG in Melbourne, the country's preeminent stadium, there's a statue commemorating the first game of Australian football. What's on that statue and what does it look like?
Well, the statue represents a leading sportsman of the time, Tom Wills, trying to separate two schoolboy footballers who were playing for Scotch and for Melbourne Grammar. And it is there to commemorate the first game of Australian football. But in fact, the basis for that is very weak. There were a lot of games of football around at the time, and they were all played by a variety of different rules.
What year are we talking about here?
This was it was the 7th of August, 1858.
That's right. Okay. And 1858. So rugby was known, of course, by that stage, wasn't it?
It wasn't, actually. There were a variety of games of football, one right. of which was played at rugby school.
That's right.
And yes. And so that was known as rugby rules. Mm-hmm. But there were other
soccer games. Soccer came later, didn't it?
It did. But there were other games associated with other schools in England, and there were games played in particularly in Sheffield, mm-hmm. which was became the powerhouse of early soccer. But as I say, a variety of different games and very different rules. And so one of the challenges of the early games was which rules are we going to abide by?
That's right. I know the AFL like to claim that they've got an arguable case to be the oldest organised football game, football code in the world, because they're older than because rugby, as you say, was only played in rugby school. It wasn't played outside of the school.
That's right.
So their argument was that when Melbourne Grammar played Scotch, then this was between schools, and therefore this was the first. There was a set of rules, and therefore that's what they're hanging their hat on. What do you make of that claim?
well, in fact, the rules for that game, as far as we can work out, were very fast and loose.
Right.
It wasn't until the following May, 1859, so that's getting on for 12 months later, that a committee met to draft up the first rules.
Right.
In Melbourne, and in that, Melbourne was well ahead of the pack in terms of other places in the world. Other games weren't really codified until the 1870s and 1880s.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Yes, the soccer came, as you say, came much later. Association football, as they call it, came much later. All right. So do those first rules bear much resemblance to the modern game of Australian rules football?
They have some resemblance, but the rules were modified dramatically over time. Mm-hmm. The early game, most people would think nowadays, would be extremely boring. It was a lot of people. There was no control on the number of players.
Right.
And it was dominated by what was called the scrimmage, which was basically sort of piles on the mill.
right,
around the ball. And the early games were very, very low scoring. It was very unusual to get a goal even.
Wasn't rugby though. It was a kicking game, was it? You had to kick the football and kick it through a goal.
You did, yes.
Right. Okay.
Basically people could rush a goal even. It was kicking and handling it as well.
Right. Okay. So anyway, so after that, the game, as you say, takes off, but. Why didn't the same thing happen in New South Wales? And why didn't New South Wales and Queensland play rugby league when the rest of the country plays AFL? I mean, I know AFL is certainly played in New South Wales. The Sydney Swans are a good side and the Giants are there as well. And Queensland certainly has its teams too, the Lions and the Suns. But you'd have to say that in New South Wales and Queensland, rugby league tends to dominate.
Very much so, yes.
Why is that?
I think the critical thing there, as so often in sport, is timing.
Mm-hmm.
That it really didn't, when there were a variety of rules around, it really didn't matter until you had an organised competition, because we could agree to play a game this afternoon, a group of friends playing, and then another group could play the following weekend, and we don't like some of those rules, so we'll change them.
Right.
It's not until you have an organised competition that really it's important to have everything codified.
And that happens in Melbourne by when?
Well, the first ones are 1859.
Right.
But in fact, the those rules were changed considerably later on in the 1860s and then again in the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the critical things there was to attract audiences, because audiences didn't like the scrimmage.
Yeah.
And they were much keener on a fast-moving game. And so there were various rules about allowing the ball to move more freely.
Right. Okay, you say, though, that one of the key reasons why Melbourne was ahead of the pack in terms of getting all this sorted, the New South Wales and Queensland weren't, was it was linked to the 8-hour day push.
That's right.
So tell me about that.
Okay. A little bit of the history on that. The first success in getting the 8-hour day in a big way was Melbourne bricklayers in 1856.
Mm-hmm.
And it very quickly spread through other skill trades in Melbourne. Originally, the 8-hour day was simply 8 hours a day for the six working days of the week, mm-hmm. Sunday being the day of rest. What unions then organised was that they would work 9-hour days or 8.5-hour days during the week and get a Saturday half holiday.
Right.
So, and that was common by mid-1860s, 1870,
right,
in Melbourne. But in fact, there was nowhere else in the world that had the 8-hour day by that stage.
Right.
The International Workers' Day on the 1st of May actually commemorates a demonstration fighting for the 8-hour day in Chicago in 1886. So that's very much later.
Much later. So in other words, all of a sudden in Melbourne, you've got a Saturday afternoon free. And so
you've got a
So if you've got a Saturday afternoon free, you can play footy and you can have a football competition.
That's right.
So that's not happening in Sydney or Brisbane at this stage.
No. Sydney and Brisbane were later getting Saturday afternoon. There were various clubs playing football of various kinds in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really until the mid-1870s that they start getting the crowds that allow you to have a regular competition.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So what about the other states? Tassie, of course, has got close ties to Melbourne.
Yes.
Adelaide and Western Australia?
Yep. I'll come on to that in just a moment.
Okay.
The other thing on timing with Sydney and then subsequently Queensland was the fact that by the time Sydney did have Saturday afternoons off, and yeah, so you start having big crowds for sporting events, by then rugby had been codified in Britain.
Okay, so what year are we talking about? Just give us some
details. This is late 1870s, 1880.
Okay.
By then, rugby has been codified, and in fact, there was a very strong push in Sydney to adopt Australian rules.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that probably would have been successful with a little bit of better marketing. But the game at that stage was called the Victorian rules. It wasn't called Australian rules.
Oh, okay. Well, that would have sunk it in New South Wales.
that's basically what happened, yes. They were much keener on an imperial game than an upstart colonial game. But to come back to your point about the Adelaide, again, very close ties with Melbourne. Perth and WA were very small populations until the 1890s.
Mm.
And in fact, in the 1890s, the population boomed in WA because of the gold rush.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the number of people going to the gold rush were overwhelmingly from Melbourne.
Uh-huh. So they took the game with them.
They took the game with them. And incidentally, they also voted for federation. In fact, the WA natives voted against joining the Commonwealth of Australia in the late 1890s. It was the vote of the Victorian miners on the goldfields that won the day for federation.
Mm. Yeah, okay. It's still interesting though that it didn't really get a foothold at all in Sydney or Brisbane, did it?
No, it didn't, and that was very much due to the fact that the rugby code was available.
But it would have been available but it would have been available in Melbourne as well.
It was not to the same codified level. There were regular competitions in Britain,
right,
by the late 1870s.
No, but I suppose I'm asking if you say the regular codified rules made it. I mean, why didn't rugby become popular in Victoria as well? You're saying by this stage, the Victorian football code had sufficient momentum, did it?
That's basically it. It was momentum. In fact, I mentioned the meeting in May 1859 when the first rules were drawn up,
mm-hmm,
and one of the people there who was Tom Wills, who's in the statue that we started talking about. Tom Wills suggested using the rugby school rules, but the other people at the meeting said they thought those rules were far too complicated,
mm-hmm,
and they wanted to go for something very, very simple and straightforward. And so they just went for a basic 10 rules.
Right.
There was some suggestion we could use rugby, but then the rugby school rules, but then people said, well, why not use the Eton rules, or why not use Harrow rules, or things like that.
Yeah. Yes, it's funny, this history, isn't it? Because we all think that football's ancient, but it's just not. it's just not. What about the regions? The Riverina of New South Wales became an Aussie rules stronghold, didn't it? Is that because they were near the border with Victoria?
It is, yes, and the railway lines for the Riverina were all down to Melbourne. They were all connecting. And taking particularly the grain crops,
right,
out from the Riverina down to Melbourne, so there was much more connection between the Riverina and also Broken Hill,
mm,
with Melbourne than there was with Sydney.
I'm talking with Tony Ward. He's a fellow in historical studies at the University of Melbourne. He's been researching the origins of Australian rules football and how it grew to be the national game, except that not really in New South Wales and Queensland. Once the code became established as pretty much a Victorian thing, there was never a chance, was there, that Queensland and New South Wales would adopt it?
Well, as I said, I think there was a chance, and in the late 1870s, and if it had been known as Australian rules, Sydney might have adopted it. In fact, there were a couple of clubs in Sydney who were playing,
right,
the Victorian game in the late 1870s. But still, at that stage, very much like in Melbourne in the 1850s, there were lots of different games played by all sorts of rules. Mm. And that was the case overseas as well. In fact, there was an early organised football match between two universities in the northeast US, between the Canadian University of McGill and Harvard. And they had to play two games against each other because they couldn't agree on the rules. And this was in, I think, about 1880 or early 1880s. One game was according to the McGill rules, which were closer to soccer, and the second game was played to the Harvard rules, which were closer to gridiron.
Yes.
So there were still all those varieties of rules around, even at that late stage in the US.
You also write that, the AFL's always drawn big crowds. The Australian rules football has always drawn big crowds. You say one of the secrets to that has also been that the code has always had attraction to women in a way that the rugby codes have less attraction.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Well, just on the first point, the Melbourne crowds, in 1875, there was a crowd of 10,000 for a footy match, but it was 15,000 by 1880. And those are huge crowds by international standards. I think a critical thing was that the ground, there was space for a lot of grounds. I mean, inner Melbourne is dotted because we have the space with a lot of ovals and parkland. So there was space to have the big crowds and for people to use their leisure time. And because there was that space, that attracted people right across the social spectrum. And importantly, and is noted by people at the time, it was very unusual that large numbers of women turned up.
Right.
Whereas in Europe and later on in the States, much smaller crowds and tighter venue facilities. And so they stayed particularly male dominated. And the crowds for rugby league in the in Sydney and in Queensland, by international standards, they have a lot more women than turn up at, for example, games in Britain or in the US or in Europe. But they're smaller numbers of women than turn up for games of in Victoria.
Very interesting. Well, anyway, New South Wales and Queensland, as you say, have their Australian rules teams these days, although it's very much a two-code state, and I guess will be forever, probably now, won't it?
I think so. One of the things that really comes through in the histories here and across the world, wherever you look at the development of sports, is the sports that were dominant in 1880 or 1900 have generally stayed dominant.
Yeah.
You know, once it gets once the snowball starts moving, young people grow up thinking, well, you know, if I'm going to star in a game, it's the game that my folks are watching.
Indeed. Interesting. All right, Tony, I shall direct all correspondence towards you.
Certainly. Well, it's obviously an area that I'm really fascinated in.
Exactly. Good to have your time.
Good. Thank you very much for your interest, Phil.
Yes, no, thank you. Tony Ward's a fellow in historical studies with the University of Melbourne.
Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.